Hi everyone, I am back home, back in my office. I'm out of Sydney, that is done. I've had a massive drive. I think I did about a couple of thousand kilometres in all, which was very good fun. So that's that. Everywhere in Australia is a long way away, for those of you who weren't sure. Long, long way away, and a lot of stuff trying to bite you or kill you or drop on you. But that's stuff for another day. I've done a heap of stuff in the last week, so I've got a lot to talk about today. And I want to jump right into it because I think a lot of it is actually going to come across a lot better as I start explaining things. Now, the first thing I might touch on, and this is not all chronological either, but some of this stuff makes more sense together. First thing I thought I'd go on to here is about password managers. And I wrote this blog post the other day and I said, password managers don't have to be perfect. They just have to be better than not having one. And here's the context. LastPass had a vulnerability, which by all accounts was quite serious, just the other day. So Tavis Ormandy, who is part of Google's Project Zero to go around and find all the bugs and all the things, tweeted out, hey, they've got some issues. LastPass said, yeah, we got some issues. Don't use the browser plugin. A few other things. People lost their minds. I don't know if you know this, but people on the internet love losing their minds. Everyone just gets into this raging mob. Anyway, a lot of people were going, here it is, this is proof, right? Like, this is the reason that we should never use a password manager because Tavis found the thing in LastPass and it's serious. And as I saw this happening, I put out a tweet which was effectively to that effect, that password managers don't need to be perfect in order to use them. And that the premise here is that people look at something like this in isolation and they go, that password manager's got a bug. Must mean that we should not use any password managers, particularly that one. Shouldn't use them at all. And what I'm really saying here is, what's the alternative? And then how does the password manager compare to the alternative? And the alternative, if you're not using a password manager, is almost certainly trying to use this. And this is a shit password manager, right? So have a look at how many unique passwords you've got across your things. At the very least, in fact, I'll rephrase that because it may not be a lot of unique passwords. How many accounts have you got? And at the very least, particularly the types of techie people that watch this, you're going to have dozens. I checked the other day in my password manager, I had 580 something, which I know is ridiculous. I've created a lot of accounts and a lot of things. I wouldn't be surprised if many of you find it is a three-digit number. If you add them all up, all over the period you've been creating accounts for. Now, even if it is just dozens, let's say it's 36, you're not going to create unique passwords for 36 different accounts that are strong. And I don't care how many people pop up and go, hey, I got this perfect formula and it works across everything and it's unique and it's strong. No, it's not. Not unless you're Rain Man. If you're Rain Man, I'm sorry, I apologize, go about your business. But you're not. So this is the point. We've got to sort of go, there are password managers over here, there is your brain over there. Which one, on balance, should you use? If password managers were crap enough or had serious enough issues, then their feasibility would drop beneath the feasibility of your brain and then you would use your brain. But that's not where we are. And the reality of it is that issues like this get so much press because they could potentially be really serious, but the actual impact of them is very, very low. So LastPass responded very quickly. They obviously have taken this extremely seriously because their whole business is built on trust. And they are now seem to be back on the right track, which is good news. So I would not have any concerns whatsoever about using LastPass. My favorite is 1Password. I like that for multiple reasons, particularly because I use the classic one where you can store your keychain offline so it stays on my machine and I sync it through other cloud services and they don't have my passwords. So use a password manager, have a read of the blog post, send that to anyone who's just gone, hey, the sky is falling, you shouldn't use them. All right, now that's that one. Moving on, I wrote my Security Sense column for Windows IT Pro. And this was about encrypted web traffic doesn't necessarily hide your weird fetishes. Here's the context. This, I'm sure, will come as news to you, but Pornhub has just gone HTTPS only. Now, this is really good, and they're not the first ones to do this. RedTube, this is not the same as YouTube Red. If you mix those up, you have an entirely different experience, allegedly. Anyway, these porn sites are going HTTPS only. Now, from the perspective of securing web traffic, this is really good because they are very big sites. They are top 100 websites in the world. They service millions of people a day. And going HTTPS only gives you all the sorts of good things that HTTPS does. You can't observe the traffic that's going backwards and forwards. You can't man in the middle of them and put nasty malware or things like that in your pages. You can have confidence that you're talking to the server that you think you are. All the things that are good about HTTPS on a banking website are also good about HTTPS on a porn site. Now, here is the nuance. And the reason I wrote this is I saw a sort of a news outlet pick this up and go, okay, well, you know, now all your weird fetishes are hidden. How do we put this delicately? Let's imagine you have a particular porn fetish, and we'll try and pick something which is relatively socially acceptable. Let's say you're really into midgets, hypothetically, and you go to Pornhub or RedTube, and they have this array of porn of all different types. I understand. And you decide you want to go in and look at the midget porn. No one knows that you're looking at that category of porn as opposed to another category of porn. And I will come back and I'll give you possibly a more relatable example in a moment as well. All right, so they don't know. Now, when I say no one knows, a man in the middle, all they know is that you're browsing something. What they also know, the man in the middle, so this could be your ISP, for example, what they do know is that you are going to Pornhub or RedTube or any of these other ones. They know that because the beginning of an HTTPS connection has a negotiation phase that can be observed. So there's this TLS handshake, backwards and forwards. I talk about it in my new course. It should land any day now. So the client basically says, look, I want to make a connection through to you. Here are the cipher suites I support and the protocols. And the server comes back and says, here's the ones I support and here's my public key. And this is observable. So your ISP knows that. Your ISP also can observe your DNS queries. So when you, hypothetically, type in pornhub.com and you end up on the Pornhub website, they can see the query to DNS. That's not encrypted. Now, imagine that rather than going to Pornhub, you were going to midgetporn.com. And I don't know if this exists. Don't go there and say it was my fault. Hypothetically. You see where I'm going, though. If the host name describes the class of adult entertainment that you're interested in, then that's your weird fetish. I'm not saying it's weird. I'm just saying some people... Digging myself in deeper here. You get the point. If the host name describes the resource and the man in the middle can still see that, even on an HTTPS connection, they can figure out what you're interested in. Let's put it in a more real-world scenario that's a little bit more relatable. Let's imagine that you are worried about your health and you go to Google and you search for a condition. When you search on Google, you will find that the results are returned over HTTPS. You may then find yourself on a generic medicine site, and that medicine site may be served over HTTPS. And as you browse around there, they got no idea whether you're worried that you've got cancer or you're worried about anxiety or something like that. It's all just the one host name. If you then go onto a site like Beyond Blue, down here in Australia, which is for anxiety and depression, a man in the middle knows that you're interested in anxiety and depression, even if it's served over HTTPS. So the point I'm trying to make here, and I'm conscious that I do espouse the virtues of HTTPS over and over and over again, is to be aware of how much is kept private and non-observable by a man in the middle, and how much is observable. Now that's particularly important because if you want to protect your browsing habits from your ISP, and if you're in the US, your ISPs are going to be able to sell your data again, so thank you very much to those guys. If you're in the UK, you've got the Snoopers Charter, which you're meant to actually call the Investigatory Powers Act, which basically says the government's going to save your data. If you're in Australia, they're going to get your metadata. All right, so even down here, where we're pretty cool about most things, government's decided you could be a terrorist, we better save all your data. So if you don't want to share that, not necessarily that you don't want to, or that you do want to hide it, it's that you don't want to share it and offer it to other people, you've got to be conscious about that. Now that segues me into the next thing. So your ISPs can see a bunch of metadata about your HTTPS traffic. So you then go, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and get a VPN. Because VPNs are a good idea, right? For private browser. And what the VPN is going to do is it's going to create a secure tunnel between your device, such as my iPhone that I'm recording on now, would encrypt it on there, all the way through to the exit node of the VPN provider. So I use a VPN called Freedome. I'm going to talk about them and another provider in just a moment. And what Freedome does is Freedome provides exit nodes around the world. So they have an exit node in Melbourne, a couple of thousand kilometers away from me, but it's my closest one. So I can encrypt my traffic from here down to their exit node in Melbourne. So as I go out through my ISP, they see a volume of data. They got no idea what it is. They don't see the DNS queries. They don't see the TLS negotiations. My traffic is encrypted to Freedome's exit node. Then it goes out of Freedome's exit node. Now, Freedome, like many VPN providers, good VPN providers, we'll come back to the distinction in a moment, they don't keep logs. So they don't associate my original IP address to the traffic. They don't store that anywhere. If I do go and browse any of the sites I've mentioned before, they're not going to be able to associate that browsing habit back to my IP address. Now that's very important. Now they run professionally and they run a good shop. I talked about them in a post I made just last night, my time. In fact, I introed it about the value of trust and integrity with a VPN provider, because you are giving them control of your traffic. So they can observe all those TLS connections, negotiations. They can observe DNS queries. They can see all of your unencrypted traffic if you go to an HTTP website. So you've got to put a lot of trust in them. And part of the reason I have chosen Freedome, I talk about this in the post, is that I know Mikko Huppinen, who is enormously well-respected, probably one of the most prominent security people in the industry. I've literally been there and seen the place, so I know it exists and it's real. And they're in Finland. And Finland is the least corrupt country in the world, which is good news, because the slightly more corrupt countries, such as this one here, and New Zealand and Canada and the US and the UK and this Five Eyes consortium and a whole bunch of the other ones as well, but the places that most people watching this are very familiar with, they don't have a real good track record when it comes to respecting the privacy of your web traffic. So I like the fact it's in Finland. Now, this brings me to the point of this next post. I wrote this blog post last night about the importance of trust and integrity in a VPN provider and how my safe VPN blew it. Now, I've got this over here on my screen. I'm going to read you some of these quotes because it's just unfathomably stupid. And I know, by the way, increasingly people are listening to this as podcasts while they have a workout or drive to work, whatever it may be. So they can't necessarily just sort of jump over and have a read of these things at the time I'm talking about them. So I'm going to read some of them out to you because they're kind of classic. So the first I heard about these guys, MySafeVPN, was I got spam a few days ago. And the topic, the subject of this spam email was Plex VPN team, or it was from Plex VPN team. The subject was new Plex VPN service. Now, if you got an email with a subject of new Plex VPN service, you may think that it's a new VPN service offered by Plex. All right, like pretty fair assumption. It's not. And what I actually found when I got this, because I looked at it and went, this is not Plex-like. It's not Plex communication at all. And when I had a look at this, it goes off to www.mysafevpn.com. You can't go there now. I'll get back to why you can't. And it was obviously some dodgy 2-bit VPN service that just looked really, really, really shady. Stuff like no HTTPS on the registration page where you actually have to sign up and buy the service, no HTTPS on login, grammatical mistakes, just looked dodgy. And as we sort of went along, I kind of tweeted this, and you know what it's like when a sort of a bit of a tweet storm starts and people chime in and add their 2 cents. Basically, people going, this looks really dodgy. And there's actually a MySafeVPN.com Twitter handle. That's the whole thing. Not MySafeVPN, that's something else. MySafeVPN.com. And whoever's behind this starts tweeting and going, look, we've actually got part of Plex's development team. And I'll read it exactly. Part of Plex's development team is working at MySafeVPN. Hence, they sent the email, the corp Plex is unhappy because they don't earn. And what whoever is behind this is saying is that there are people working for Plex who have started up this service or who are working for this service. Therefore, it's not spam, which first of all is bullshit, because if you send unsolicited email in this fashion, it's spam no matter where you work. And then Plex has chimed in and went, this is just a flat out lie. Neither our company or any of our employees are affiliated with you. And as it sort of unfolds, it just gets scammier and scammier. So there's a point here where someone says, oh yeah, I just got one exactly the same, except it's about Boxy. And the subject is Boxy is now back as mysafevpn.com. Both Boxy and Plex had data breaches that exposed hundreds of thousands of people. And what seems to have happened is whoever has stood up this service has just gone through and emailed everyone in the data breach and said, hey, you know, there's now this VPN service, you should go and give us money. So anyway, the thing keeps unfolding, and basically the person behind MySafeVPN just rants in really incomprehensible ways. So they do stuff like they say, okay, we're going to help sort of secure your users, Plex, because you didn't do a good enough job of it, which is ridiculous because Plex, the vulnerability which led to the exploit, was in a third-party forum software called IP Board. It was a vulnerability which inevitably led to something like SQL injection, which a VPN does absolutely nothing to prevent. It goes on and on, and you know they're just arguing over random stuff. That this account is going, we've got to get, they keep saying SSL. We'll forgive them for that, SSL, TLS, a bit interchangeable. They keep saying, hey, we're going to install our SSL shortly. It's expensive and it takes a long time. And then my mate Scott Helm jumps in here and goes, no, it's not. It's cheap and it's fast. You go to Let's Encrypt or you go to Cloudflare or something like that. And first of all, Scott runs training called the world's best TLS training. Like, this is what he does. He's one of the most knowledgeable people in the world about TLS. So these guys try to start teaching him about it. And they go, this is a funny one, not sure what kind of self-signed horrible SSL you're talking about. You should head over to Namecheap and check out the real SSL. And eventually they ended up paying hundreds of dollars for a Komodo certificate because apparently that is the proper SSL and Let's Encrypt is not. So good on them. And then remember, they're offering a crypto service here, which is a VPN. And it goes on and on. I end up calling their helpline, keep getting through to a recorded message. Eventually, I have someone answer who sounds like a very young male or very effeminate guy, and they're just saying hello and they're not even talking properly. You know, like they're not saying, welcome to MySafeVPN, anything like that. I then find out that it looks like their location is a Vietnamese restaurant. So their registered address. I'm looking at the picture here. They've got a few orange chairs or a few red chairs sitting at the front. There's a very good rating of the Vietnamese restaurant on Yelp. Apparently the Fogar is very good. So anyway, it goes on. This guy's arguing and, you know, ranting and ranting. Eventually, as of today, they've been shut down. So it looks like their DNS records have been put under suspension. So there's no more DNS resolution, which has taken them offline. They've tweeted something about, oh yeah, we're just going to rebrand and then basically scam again. So it is just the weirdest thing where you're kind of going, is this person deliberately malicious or just stupid? And it's honestly sometimes hard to tell the difference. Anyway, it could actually be both. Let's not rule out both. So that was that. You know, scammers are going to scam. That's kind of what they do. So hopefully that's the end of that one. Shame about the $400-odd Komodo certificate now that the domain's suspended. Not really a shame. All right, next thing. While we're talking about this sort of class of actor, the Turkish crime family. So last week I mentioned that I had done a bit of research into the data they had. And if you remember, that the whole premise here of TCF, Turkish Crime Family, was that they said they had hundreds of millions of Apple accounts. And if Apple didn't pay them $75,000 by today, the 7th of April, they were going to nuke the accounts. So they're going to delete data and remote wipe devices. Now, this sounds like a money grab right from the outset. It sounds infeasible because you simply don't grab hundreds of millions of Apple accounts easily. It certainly wouldn't be easy. You don't have the passwords in plain text because there's no way Apple would be storing them in that sort of fashion. And you're really going to have no ability to do what they said they were going to do. Now, I got data from Zach Whitaker at ZDNet. So he got about 60,000 odd records. In fact, what I'm going to do, I'm going to find the window with the details on it and then I can read them out to you. He got 69,000 records from them. And they went, here is our proof, right? Like, this is the sample of data we have. Now, out of that, there were just under 53,000 unique email addresses. So already we start sort of chopping away at the total scope. Now, here's where it got interesting, because what Zach wanted me to do is to try and see if we could figure out where the data had come from. So I plugged it into Have I Been Pwned, and I didn't manually enter them. I do have direct access to the back end, so I can circumvent rate limits and things like that. And I went through and I found that there were a total of almost 41,000 of those records in the Evony data breach. Now, Evony is a gaming site that I loaded in just a few weeks ago. And out of all of those email addresses, a huge majority, so out of all the ones in Evony, a huge majority had the same password in Evony. And so I'm looking at this going, the bulk of data that these guys have given us has just come straight out of Evony, right? And here is the proof, here's the evidence. And beyond that, I'm going to open up the actual post I wrote here and find some of the other sort of key points. But beyond that, I then found a lot of the other data was in data breaches such as Last.fm. I could actually tie it back to Last.fm. And in fact, what I did here, I went through an exercise where I got the hashes out of Last.fm, they're just MD5 hashes. I got the plain text passwords out of the data which TCF came from Apple, matched the email addresses, and then said, well, look, do these passwords match these hashes? So I just went through a hash cracking exercise. I had a word list, which was the plain text passwords in the Apple data, a hash list, which was from Last.fm, and I went, look, do these match up? And about a third of them did, which is a very, very high hit rate. So effectively, I kind of chipped away at this and went, I know that the bulk of data came from Evony, a big whack of it came from Last.fm. A huge number of the accounts listed here also appear in LinkedIn, MySpace, other data breaches. This is what's happened. They pulled the data from breaches. Now, they themselves, I'm pretty sure at some stage, said this data did not actually come from Apple. It came from other breaches, but it works on Apple. And there's hundreds of millions of them. But one of the interesting things I found is that when I took this list of 69,000 rows, 52,000 odd unique email addresses, and I said, all right, now let's go and look at this Evony data breach where so much of the data is. How many of the email addresses in Evony that are Apple addresses, so things like me.com, are in this data provided by TCF? And basically it was all of them. So when they say we've got this small slice, like a fraction of a percent, about 0.2%, 0.02%, got all this data, and here is, like, here's the sample, the 0.02%. It effectively all came from Evony. So all of the Apple accounts in Evony came out, went into this Apple sample set, and then they got stuff from other places. So it was starting to look really dodgy, and I sort of made the point that they've said we've got all of this data, here's a tiny sample, and that is actually probably all they have. Out of that, there's a whole bunch with passwords that don't actually work, because Zach spoke to people who went, yeah, that's my password, but I changed it 2 years ago. Then Apple's got the data, so Apple knows all the accounts that they think they're going to reset, and they will take proactive measures against those. And then there'll be a small number of people that actually have multi-step authentication turned on as well. So even if you have the right password, you're not going to be able to get in the account. And when you keep filtering this down, you get to the point where you go, these guys have got nothing, right? Almost nothing. Almost nothing. A rounding error of a fraction of a percent is what they might have. Now, all of that's kind of interesting. And I then sort of go and I talk a little bit about the way Zach characterized them. And Zach's got this tweet here. He says, immature and naive hacker thinks wiping 200 million iPhones will get him rich and not bludgeoned to death by an angry mob. How cute. Now, there's a little tangential follow-up here. I'm going to find the actual... Your thing is probably like my thing, your browser, in that you have lots and lots of windows. There's an interesting interesting follow-up in that Zach tweeted this on the 27th of March, just here. I was listening to the Risky Business podcast today. If you don't listen to Risky Biz and you're interested in anything InfoSec, go and listen to them. It's an Australian one. and it is continually awarded the best one in the world. If not the best, then very, very close to the best. Anyway, listening to that, and Patrick has mentioned that the UK cops had arrested someone. I wasn't aware of this. And this is actually March 29, so 2 days later than Zach's tweet. UK cops arrest man potentially linked to Apple extortion. And when they say man, apparently it was a young 20-year-old male who's been arrested in the UK for this. So that's kind of curious. It seems that there are multiple people involved who right now should be pretty damn concerned about their future freedom, if I was them. So that's that. They've sort of been caught there. But also, when we actually have a look at their Twitter account, they're kind of still going on. So I'm looking at a tweet here from 4 hours ago saying, 7 April 2017, 7:30 p.m. GMT, which appears to be their deadline they're talking about. That's going to happen not too far from now. So that is going to happen in about 14 hours. And in 14 hours, it's probably not going to look real good for them. But, you know, we'll see. Maybe they'll have a few and it will just be normal old credential stuffing thing and it'll get a few headlines. It's not going to be hundreds of millions of accounts reset, though, which is good because we don't want that to happen. All right, so that's that one. Now, a couple more things. So first of all, sponsor-wise, I've got Titania sponsoring me this week. So I'm really glad to have those guys there. I actually met someone from Titania when I was over in San Francisco for RSA conference. One of the things I really like about this sponsorship model is it does give me relationships with organizations. And I don't mean to say that's good from a commercial sense. The sponsorship certainly is, but it's a great way to meet people and learn about new things. So go and check them out. I really appreciate having those folks around. I'm vacant from the end of next week onwards, which, putting this in date terms, will be the 16th of April. Someone suggested the other day, they said, hey, look, if you're vacant, rather than leaving the spot empty, why don't you give a plug to an open source or a community project or something like that? I think that's a bloody good idea. If I don't fill spots commercially, then I'll think about doing that and try to give someone some airtime in a positive way. Now, one more thing, because that's normally where I wrap up with a sponsor. Someone asked me a question the other day. In fact, they sent me an email. They said, I'd be really interested in knowing what your computer setup is. So what computers do you use? What software do you use? And I thought this is probably a good medium to talk about that because I can show you. So I'll show you what I use. And this is sort of my everyday stuff. First of all, the iPhone. Obviously, I have an iPhone 7 Plus. I like the big screen because I can do a lot of stuff with it. You can even RDP into servers with it, which is not fun. But if I'm out and about and I need to do something, that's actually kind of handy. Other reason I love it is 1080p front camera, so it makes this sort of stuff really good. A lot of people are amazed when they look at videos like this, and I've got only natural lighting here as well, and they go, wow, that's a really good video quality. Yeah, because of 1080p camera. So there's that. I use my iPad really extensively as well. So I've got an iPad Air 2. I use that a lot for consuming information. So I often get up early in the day and I will sit around having a coffee while it's still dark here, reading my emails, reading my Twitters, using things like Flipboard to read stories, which is enormously handy. So this is a great device for that. Very happy with that one. And then we get to laptops. So I have spoken many times before about how I'm part of Lenovo Insiders, where they give me some hardware and I share what I do with that hardware. So that includes my Yoga 900. So this is a really, really nice machine, super thin like that. It's very, very light. I don't know what it is exactly in weight, but it's an amount I don't notice. So when I walked a marathon and a bit in San Francisco recently, I carried that around. And what's neat about it, this is where the video works well, is you can do this, right? So it goes like that, and it goes all the way around. So you can use it as a tablet, which is kind of cool. And you can also use it in like tent mode. We can sit it there and watch movies. Sometimes I will actually sit it there like this. So often when I'm doing talks at conferences, I will have this laptop sitting there and it's just got notes and references and things like that, which I find really handy. So this is a great machine. It's still fast enough. It's got 16 gigabytes of RAM. It's got a bunch of capacity. It's got 256 gig. It's not a lot, but it's enough to do most of the stuff I need to do. Now, the really good one. So this is my P50, and I've written about the P50 before as well. And the P50 is a beast of a machine. It's heavy, and you can see sort of how thick it is. We can see fans and venting and everything else. It's definitely not the prettiest machine. That Yoga is a very pretty machine, but it is enormously good at being a remote workhorse, because it's got a quad-core CPU that is a Xeon processor, so it's pretty much a server processor in it. I've put 64 gigabytes of RAM in it, and in case you're saying, why the hell do you need 64 gigabytes of RAM? I do a lot of processing of data breaches in SQL Server, and SQL Server will eat every last byte of RAM it can get its hands on. So I do regularly use 64 megabytes of RAM. It has also got an NVMe disk, so they're the ones with their little chips on a stick, as opposed to even an SSD. That's a, I think it was a Samsung 980 Pro from memory. Super fast disk. I've actually got two of those. There was a 256 gig one in it. I bought a 512 one because I needed more capacity on my primary. And it's got a terabyte of spinning Rust disk as well. And it's serviceable, right? Because you can pull all these disks out and do whatever you need to with them. And that is a great machine. That's a 15-inch screen. You can get a P70, which is a 17-inch screen. But this is about right, because then it really starts to get big. So that is awesome. Now, the other thing that I use, and I pick the camera up here, is I do actually have a desktop machine. So this is what I normally look at. And there's all my notes and other things like that. And the reason why I've still got those machines, or rather that machine, is because this basically stays here. It stays on the whole time. I'm going to dock this phone and camera again. And the great thing about that is I can always come back up here to my office, and I've got everything set up and everything I need. And it's got all of these screens, which, as you just saw, I sort of fill with different stuff. So I've got my notes I'm reading from, the website I was just looking at with Turkish Crime Family and blog posts, Audacity, which records off the microphone you might have seen. And I've got my Unify Ubiquity thing up here because I'm doing some stuff with my network at the moment as well. So it's just great to have like mission control. And you go in here and it feels like you're on the Starship Enterprise or something like that, which is pretty cool. Software-wise, I use very predictable things. So I live in Outlook. I send a lot of emails. Twitter in the browser. I use Chrome for just about everything I do browser-wise. What else am I using here? I just mentioned Audacity for audio recording. I use Photoshop and Illustrator a bit for anything visual. I use, what else have I got down here? Like many people, Slack, for particularly for my Pluralsight communications. And obviously Visual Studio, SQL Server, the whole Microsoft suite of tools. I use Notepad++ and Sublime a lot. I use Visual Studio Code, particularly when I'm working on the template for my blog. Probably nothing that's overly surprising, to be completely honest. So that is the gear that I use. It's a lot of machines. I sync everything up via Dropbox, so everything's pretty much on everything anytime I need it. I tend to end up leaving that P50 downstairs in the kitchen and leaving the other machine up here, and I'll sort of context switch a lot. I like to go to a different place for a different bit of scenery and work there. And then I normally just turn on the Yoga when I go out somewhere. So if I go out on the jet ski, for example, and want to take it and do some work, that comes with me and it syncs up, magic happens, and I have all my work no matter where I go. So I think that's it. This one went for a long time, which means my Australian bandwidth is really going to struggle now. So I'm going to count it there. I hope this was useful, both in terms of all the stories and the things I use. If anyone's got any questions they want me to answer next time as well, let me know. Maybe that's of interest to some people. Thanks very much for watching. I'm still going to be here next week and for many weeks after that, until I go away to Europe at the end of May. So I will see you here in a week. Thanks, everyone.